next. Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show interview was recorded last week. It may seem a little bit strange, given the unsettling times in which we are living right now, but today on the morning show, we're going to be talking about happiness, of all things. And I'm very excited that in this conversation, I can reconnect with Ginny Sassaman, who has been on the morning show before, and she was here in person in our studios some time ago to talk about Gross National Happiness USA, a project that she has helped to oversee, and she has spoken extensively on the topic of happiness and positive psychology. And it's important to say that it is a very sturdy kind of happiness that she she espouses, and it's a kind of happiness that is actually very, very relevant even in the times that we are living through right now, that would seem on the surface to not be happy whatsoever. But in fact, there is happiness to be found, happiness and well-being. And in some respects, what we are experiencing right now is probably helping us learn new lessons about what real happiness is, what matters most in life, and so on. Ginny Sassaman has written a new book, which is called Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. It's published by Rootstock Publishing, and we're going to talk about what prompted her to put this book together, which actually is a series of sermons that she has presented on this important topic. And Ginny Sassaman is speaking to us via telephone from her home in Vermont. Ginny Sassaman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, I'm really happy to be here, even if I can't be in the studio with you. I know you've also had my daughter Jennifer on the air multiple times, and she's a theater professor at Parkside, and that's how you and I first connected, is us having Wisconsin connections and coming out there. And I am also excited because you are the first interviewer I'm talking with about the book, and I think you do a great job, so I am happy to start with you.
Very good. I'm excited as well. We should maybe mention that our original plans, although I don't know that we had gotten anything very specifically scheduled, but the intention was for you to come to the studio because it was our visit about the book was going to happen while you were here visiting in southeastern Wisconsin. And then as the COVID-19 crisis really sort of swelled in seriousness and severity, you made the decision that you needed to return home to Vermont. And so that's why this conversation needs to be over the phone. We'll mostly talk about the book. I think it's appropriate for us to begin, first of all, by talking about this current situation that, of course, is so unsettling, and it has shaken us from many of the pursuits and activities that have made us happy, and suddenly we find ourselves unable to go to concerts or go to a ball game or go to church choir practice or go bowling or any number of other activities with which we have filled our lives. Although we're still in the midst of it, I suspect you have already been thinking a whole lot about how this current situation is affecting all of us and affecting our own happiness. What kinds of things have you been thinking about?
Well, I've been thinking that this book is extremely timely, actually, because I came into the happiness movement from a different door than a lot of other people. A lot of people are really interested in the personal happiness movement and positive psychology, as I am as well. But my first interest was in changing the systems, the overarching systems that affect us all. And to me, the two must go hand in hand, that we need to understand truly what makes us happy. And happiness, of course, is not just about pleasure. That's a component, but it's about so much more, and it's so deep. So we need to understand our personal happiness, our personal well-being, and then we need to understand also our commitment to each other. And COVID-19 is certainly showing us that. We are interconnected. There's just no getting around it. And we need to not only grow our own personal happiness, but we need to look at the structures which govern our lives and think about how to change those so that it supports maximum well-being for all of us, and including, especially even, nature and animals, with whom we're also totally interconnected. I'm shook up too. I mean, who wouldn't be? But I do see in this moment an opportunity for us all to dig a little bit deeper in our personal understanding, and also we can't help but see our interconnection. So to really think about, wait a minute, like, what systems would have helped us avoid getting here? What systems would make it easier for us to rebound, not just individually, but collectively?
Mm.
And just one more piece there. It's really amazing and beautiful, the whole purpose of all the self-quarantining and self-isolation and social distance. Yes, we ourselves want to keep ourselves healthy and our immediate loved ones who we may be interacting with daily, but it's also been sold to us, even more importantly, it's about keeping other people healthy. Mm. It's about keeping our seniors and those with compromised systems healthy and alive. So this whole moment is very much not just about the individual, but it's about the collective, and that is really, to me, what happiness is all about.
Very, very well put, and I think you're right. There's all kinds of things that we see with a new kind of clarity because so much around us has changed. And on my Facebook feed this morning came up what happens nearly every day when someone subscribes to Facebook is it will pull up a picture or a video that you posted either a year ago or a couple of years ago on that this
right,
very
day.
Right. And the one that popped up for me this morning was a brief little video I took of the bell choir at my church playing a really beautiful song. And I shared that this morning with the heading, I will never take a scene like this for granted. ever again.
There you go. I mean, gratitude is, I think a lot of people know this already, but it is true. Gratitude is a huge component of personal happiness. And again, when we practice that on a personal basis, we can see it extending out and radiating out to our communities. Here's one that I've been seeing this on Facebook. Gratitude to grocery store workers, that never before have I think really appreciated the absolutely key role that a grocery store workers play in our well-being, and how now, you know, they are on the front lines to keep us healthy. So, you know, big shout out to any of you grocery store workers.
Absolutely.
So.
We're speaking with Ginny Sassaman, and we're talking about a book that has just been published called Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. So you have been exploring the principle of happiness for a while now, but in some respects, some of your deepest understandings of happiness have come relatively late in your life. In the preface to the book, you say, as for my own happiness, it didn't show up in a full-blown way until about my fifth career. And
yeah,
this
right.
This comes after you have described the essentially your professional background and some of the really interesting things that you have done. Maybe you should sketch that briefly for our listeners, and then let's talk about the way in which it was by career number five that you came to a deeper understanding and experienced for yourself a deeper kind of happiness than before.
Right. That makes me think I should preface this by saying, even though the title is Preaching Happiness, and yes, it is sermons, some of my own friends sort of have the heebie-jeebies with that because they don't ascribe to any particular religion or church. So these were all sermons that were given in Unitarian Universalist settings, and for those who aren't familiar with that, you know, the UU world is one in which people can bring their own their own belief system, really. So these are very secular sermons, that it doesn't really matter what a person's individual religious belief is. This kind of includes everybody, every religion or lack thereof. So it can speak to anybody, no matter your belief. I like to tell the story that maybe I was meant to be a happiness preacher. That there is this family myth that when I was just like 18 months old, my mother heard me making noises in the crib and came in to see what the baby needed. And when she came in the room, I was rocking back and forth saying, happy, happy, happy. So maybe it was my destiny, but it did take a long time to get there. And I have worked in Washington, D.C. for groups like Common Cause and the American University as their media person. Then I was a full-time watercolor painter, doing the arts and crafts show thing. Then I went to graduate school to become a mediator. And then I started reading about happiness. And I had just a major aha moment reading a book called The Geography of Bliss, which is by a former NPR correspondent, Eric Weiner. And I first read about the gross national happiness concept in that book, and it was an immediate, like, lightning strikes, life-transforming moment that I just, that became my calling, and I do feel like sort of preaching the gospel of happiness is my calling in life. So then it was a process of educating myself. What does gross national happiness mean, learning about positive psychology, putting the two together. And meanwhile, my own church, which is the Unitarian that I attend, the Unitarian Church of Montpelier, asked me one day to, if I wanted to be a guest preacher. And I very much did, because kind of as your intro discussed, people can think of happiness as a very light subject, and to me it is anything but. You know, the more we genuinely build our own happiness, the better suited we are to serve the world. And so I thought it was really appropriate in a church setting. So that was back in 2013. And since then, I have visited many different churches, including Olympia Brown in Racine. And then a couple of years ago, in 2017, a church near me, which is in a Vermont summer area, and they only have church services in the summer, asked me to come do most of their services. So I have done most of their services in the summer for the last 3 years. And about halfway through that, as I was writing these pieces, I realized that it was a book. And I also felt like there are a couple of things about this that make it different and maybe more accessible to kind of anybody. One is, you know, I learned from like an academic superstar, and you know, there are some very sort of glittery happiness people out there. Well, that is not me. I feel like I'm just a regular person.
Right.
And that if I can learn about these concepts, which come from, you know, brain science and poetry and so many different fields, if I can learn about these concepts and bring them into my own life, so can just about anybody. So I feel like I'm reaching out as like one regular person to all the rest of you out there who also are just people going about your lives. So that's one thing that I think is a little bit different. And then there is the nature of sermons themselves. So I think often nobody wants to be preached at unless they are going to church and want to be preached at then. You know, when I'm standing in the pulpit and I look out at whoever is there in the congregation and see everybody's faces, you know, there's this awareness that everybody wants something. I don't know that anybody knows what it is, but, you know, they come to church wanting something to take away some inspiration or a quote or something comforting or something motivating. So I think that, I hope that when people pick up the book, they're coming to it with that same kind of attitude, that they want something, and I want to offer that to people.
One of the things I appreciate about the preface is that you really kind of help us understand how your life's journey has provided you with all kinds of building blocks for this this very full understanding that you have about what it really means to be happy and the way in which true happiness can really galvanize us, you know, for our presence in the world. In that preface, one of the really intriguing stories that you tell, without going into a whole lot of detail, but it's a very poignant little moment, is when you talk about a time when you were a teenager and you were in an interracial relationship. So you were dating a young man of another race, and you experienced resistance to that from several different people in your life. And the way that story kind of ultimately ends, I think, is really quite profound. I wonder if you would mind sharing that story with our listeners.
No, I'm happy to share that story. I feel like it was a key moment in shaping me. And for some of your younger listeners especially, I should say this happened quite a few years ago. I think a lot of attitudes have shifted since then. But at the time, I was in an overwhelmingly white junior high school and in an overwhelmingly white and fairly conservative part of Pennsylvania. And it was just not okay to have a relationship with someone from another race. But I was too naive to even know that. And I was just, when I got a call from this fellow, and, you know, he was cute and a football player, and I just, you know, man, I wanted a boyfriend. So, but what I found was so many people in the school, including teachers, like, suddenly hated me. But what happened that was so amazing, we traveled in sections or cohorts. And in my cohort, I had two very close friends, and both their parents said they were not allowed to be my friend anymore. So they just cut me off. But the other people in my cohort kind of, they galvanized around me. And at the time, it was so welcome and so comforting. And it helped to teach me to be brave and to speak my truth. And to stand up for what I believe to be right. It also ultimately helped teach me compassion, not in the moment, but reflecting back on it. I felt so sad for my two friends, because then the class turned against them. So they were only doing what their parents told them to do, and that must have been very hard for them to be ostracized like that. So there was a lot of learning. That the main learning was, we need to speak our truth.
Mm. Let's probe a little further into your book, and let's remind our listeners again that the book is titled Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. And this book is a series of sermons, actually, that you delivered on the topic of happiness. We've actually already touched a little bit on one of the main points of the very first chapter of the book, which is titled Happiness for Everyone, Our Moral Obligation to Change the Economic Paradigm. And this actually touches on something which you speak of in the preface, and you've already talked about how from a very early age you were someone who cared about justice and social justice. And, you know, in a lot of respects, this turns on its head the more shallow notions that we might have about what happiness is or what it means to be happy. And I think for some people, they think the key to being happy is to kind of stick your head in the sand. I mean, stop reading the news, stop listening to sad stories about other people and their miseries. And if you can sort of keep yourself encased in a safe bubble, and just care about yourself, that seems like a really good way to be happy. And of course, you are talking about a kind of happiness that is completely different from that, which acknowledges what needs to be changed in our world and is willing to engage in trying to bring those changes about. I mean, that is a very different kind of happiness than the casual happiness that a lot of people like to talk about.
Right, and I have always been interested in social justice. And I am also interested in joy. And I mean, as far as I know, we only have one life to live. And I want us to live it with as much laughter and music and art and love as possible. But I feel like in this country, we have way oversold the value of the individual perspective. You know, there is a value in the individualist, I can do this, I can take care of it. But again, as we're seeing with COVID-19, nobody can. We're all by themselves. We're all connected. So I think we need to view all of this as one big mixture. And it can be done. It can be done. I mean, I talk in that chapter about different ways of framing how we define both personal success and overall society success. And we're so focused now, and I think we've all internalized this, we define success so much based on money and material well-being and power, status. But if you look into your own life and you think, what are the many aspects within your own life that make you happy? Sure. Especially now, I do not want to disparage the need to feel economically secure and, you know, to have the food and the health care you need to take care of your children, all of those things. But it's a much more complicated picture about what we as individuals need to be happy. And some of the things the book touches on that might not be as readily apparent are beauty. You know, if you were to imagine a life without beauty, I mean, that is really stark. And, I mean, who wants to live that kind of life? Or a life without being creative through music or gardening or storytelling, whatever it is. We need creativity. We need relationships. We need conflict resolution skills. We need forgiveness. We need kindness. We need mindfulness. We need good health. We need good food. It's a whole complex set of factors that we need for our own happiness. And yet, if you look at, again, like the national measures, it's like, how is the GDP, the gross domestic product, doing? It's like, that's just a tiny piece. So we need to refocus what truly can support the pursuit of happiness for everyone. And I emphasize, you know, I think two of the most poignant sermons for me were the one on our connection with nature and also the one on our connection with animals. Because right now, we are, well, before COVID-19, we were really, really destroying our natural world. And yet we ourselves cannot survive, much less be happy, without a healthy natural world. And the same is true with animals, which are going extinct. We need to protect our fellow sentient beings, not just out of the goodness of our heart, though that would be great, but also for our own happiness, our own well-being. Mm. So it's very much a collective. And there's one image that, to me, kind of a visual image that can kind of put this into perspective. So many of your listeners may have seen, after Hurricane Michael hit the Florida panhandle a couple of Septembers ago, and they may remember the town of Mexico Beach was just flattened. mile after mile after mile of just flattened houses, the whole town. And there was one picture, one photograph of a house that was still standing, that had been built more recently and built more strongly and did not get flattened. So there's this house standing. So, but what do you think the owners of that house felt like? And I saw the owner interviewed, and he was crying. He's like, what do I care, basically, that my own house is still standing when all my friends and neighbors, their house, they're gone, and many of the people were killed. So we cannot focus on our own happiness alone. That's like that house standing by itself after Hurricane Michael. We need all of us.
We're speaking with Ginny Sassaman, and we're talking about her book, Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. In the second chapter of your book, Happiness Runs in a Circular Motion, you tell a very interesting story that helps us understand what I think at one point in the chapter you describe as the interdependence of happiness and sadness. It's an experience that you had at one point in your life with a very serious eye problem. I mean, that could have been perhaps far more serious than it turned out to be, but it was an unpleasant and scary situation. And yes, during this experience, you say, I unwittingly made the perfect happiness choice. So I want you to tell our listeners about that, but first, a little bit of background would be helpful, I think.
Yes. So I was having symptoms that didn't... flashing is... symptoms, and there's something called floaters, which a lot of people experience. That part is not uncommon. So I went to get my eyes checked and was sent immediately to a retinal specialist. And the retina specialist looked in my eye and was like, it's like everything in the room changed. And the long and short of it is, I have a disease, which is often caused by diabetes or high blood pressure, but in my case it was just caused by being nearsighted and just really stretching the capacity of my eye, something called retinal neovascularization, which means bleeding, hemorrhaging in the retina. So what the doctor told me was that disease, if left untreated, could cause blindness within a matter of months. It was just in my left eye, so it would have been, if I had not gotten to the doctor, I could have gone blind in my left eye within months. And the treatment for that is, it's something which sounds a lot scarier than it really is, but they inject a drug right into your eye. It's not as bad as it sounds, but it sure did sound horrible. So it was shocking. It was traumatic. I had read enough. I knew quite a bit about happiness by that point, and I knew that even Christopher Reeve, the actor who was became a quadriplegic after a horse accident, bounced back eventually and became happy. So I was walking around the house practicing with my hands over my eyes, like, what would happen if I went blind? And the decision that I made that was so helpful was, so I have a blog, happinessparadigm.com, and I just wrote about this. I didn't want to see any of my friends. I wanted to be alone because I was scared. This was I had a couple of days between the diagnosis and getting that needle in my eye. So I was scared and traumatized and just wanted to be with my husband. But I wrote about it. And I had this amazing outpouring of love and support online, which is, you know, kind of a precursor to where we are right now, that now we're all really reaching out to each other online. But that showed me the value of social media, because so many people just stepped up and they offered to help me in any way they could, and just, you know, wishing me best. And it just filled my heart with gratitude. And then there were many other things. It's back to gratitude again, but there were many other things that I had to be grateful for. You know, I had health insurance. So there's that systems piece. I mean, if I hadn't had health insurance, I don't know what I would have done. I mean, how much does a retinal specialist and, you know, an eye-saving drug, how much does that cost? So I had health insurance. I had good medical care. I had so many things to be grateful for. But I think another key piece of this story, so we all have our own version of that story, whether it's a health story or someone else's health, and especially going into, we haven't hit the worst of COVID by a long shot, there will be pain and there will be suffering and there will be grieving. And I think it's really, really important to feel that. We need to feel the sad when we are sad. We need to feel the anger. We need to feel the fear. We need to feel bad. We just don't need to wallow in it. And for me, I had the permission to feel as bad as I needed to feel, because I knew the happiness tools. I knew I could get back to that place. I knew what to do to feel better when it was time to feel better. Mm. And so I think that's an important message for everybody. There was so much in that. The systems piece, the gratitude piece, the reaching out to others, and the relationship piece, but also, and perhaps this is the one that people don't know as well, is sadness is an important component of happiness. In fact, in Bhutan, the country where the gross national happiness concept originated, they try to practice it. They focus on these skills as a country. I don't know if it's a requirement or it's a request, but they ask every person in the country to focus on death for about an hour every day, with an awareness that by facing up to the sadness, facing up to the pain and the fear, and accepting it as a natural part of who we are much, much better equipped to laugh.
In the third chapter of your book, which talks about growing our happiness muscles in order to build a better world, that is a nice image, and again, points to a very robust kind of happiness. You spell out a really interesting relationship between activism and happiness, and go so far as to say that some of the happiest moments you've experienced in your life have been while you were doing work as an activist. I mean, maybe at a huge rally, I think you describe one in this chapter, and other instances where you are doing good in the world as an activist, and it just makes you happy. But the relationship between activism and happiness is a little more complicated than that. And in some ways, you feel like it's important to sort of flip that equation on its head. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yes, and again, very, very timely information. And I would say that what I'm talking about with activism applies to whatever it is that people do individually. All your listeners, again, the grocery workers, the medical staff, the moms and dads teaching their kids at home. But whatever it is that we individually, where we find the meaning in our lives, that meaning gives us joy. So the meaning gives us joy. But when we practice our happiness skills, that gives us the strength and the joy to continue. And there are many different ways to do that. I, for example, work with a local group of activists, and we put a huge emphasis on relationships and feeling. Like, how is everybody doing today? And it's that social bonding, it's that social capital that enables us to do our best activism. There are other ways to do this as well. The book, I also want to say, cites many, many different researchers who have done great work in the field, and there are there's EndNotes to connect everybody to those people's work to delve in a little bit deeper. But one of them is a woman named Barbara Fredrickson, who is from the University of North Carolina, and she came up with this concept of broaden and build, which is to say, when we're depressed, when we're angry, when we're just shut down in one way or another, we're not at our best in whatever it is we do. And I compare that to, like, cold water. When we're in cold water or the cold Wisconsin wind, we kind of shrink into ourselves. Mm. When we open up to positivity, when we look for the good, when we build our happiness muscles, we also are more creative in our problem solving, we're more resilient, our relationships are stronger. So building the positive within ourselves is really valuable in creating a better world for everybody else. Another strategy that is in that same chapter that I think is really helpful and available to everyone. So some of the earliest positive psychologists came up with a theory that it's really best for us to know our personal strengths, our individual virtues, and what matters, what each of us is truly in our core best at. And they came up with a list of 24 universal virtues and strengths that each of us has, but also each of us has a couple of those that is really our very, very best selves. So these folks have an online little quiz that you can sit down and take the survey, and it will tell everybody listening, it will tell you what your core strengths are. And you can find it, just Google VIA Virtues in Action Institute, and you can find this little survey. And then when you know what you are really best at, you can take those strengths out into your activism or whatever work gives you meaning, and come from that place.
Hmm.
Rather than trying to be, you know, a person you're not. So for me, some of the strengths for me are the capacity to give and receive love. So I take that out into the world. Like, how can I use that in this time, at any time? There's always suffering, there's always crisis, but how can I use that? But it will be different for each of us. For some people it will be creativity, some people it's beauty. One of my friends is, he is just a real learner, and love of learning is one of these strengths. And so he has been learning everything he can about COVID, and then sharing that with the rest of us so we have a better understanding. So, yes, using your strengths and just generally recognizing that happiness and positivity is not selfish. it is for the greater good.
Hmm.
I mean, you can use it in a selfish way, but I would urge everybody to understand that it is a tool to be a creator of a better world.
Hmm. I want to make sure that people understand that your book goes into other directions as well. There's a chapter called All You Need Is Love, but it's complicated, in which you talk about the significant role of relationships in love, and what you call micro moments of love that we can have with others, even with people that we don't necessarily know very well. There's a chapter on mindfulness and compassion, in which you explore what mindfulness is and what a significant player it can be in our own well-being. I really love the chapter 6, in which you talk about social comparison. You tell a really great story, yes, about how so often we fall prey to comparing ourselves to others. You tell an amazing story of being an artistic exhibitor at a gala at which fancy treats are being given, and that's only for the wealthy patrons of this event, right, not for you exhibitors, and you are looking at that and resenting that, but it ultimately ends with a wonderful story about realizing, but I'm happy, and I need to stop comparing myself to people with more money or people with more this or that. It's that whole chapter is just replete with great insights. And also there is a chapter in your book which talks about conflict and how often the road to happiness includes some conflicts along the way. And in that chapter, you touch upon your work as a mediator. I think it's back in the preface that you actually say, over the course of your life and your many careers, you have encountered lesson upon lesson over the years, lesson upon lesson about what it means to be happy. And your book is just packed from front to back with so many of those lessons that you explore in really lovely fashion. And I want to also add that your book is full of footnotes. So in other words, this is a book that's very carefully and seriously crafted. And I appreciate that great care as well. The book is Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World, a great book to be reading even at this moment in time that we find ourselves. The book is published by Rootstock Publishing. It can be ordered at rootstockpublishing.com/books. And Ginny Sassaman, in the midst of what in some respects is a very unhappy and scary time for all of us, I really appreciate that your book is entering the world and can be enjoyed by all of us. And I really appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show for this conversation. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it as well.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, as if to step back into a simpler time, we're going to remember the great American genius Mark Twain. I'm going to be rebroadcasting a conversation I recorded some years ago with Bob Hurst, who helped to edit a new edition of the autobiography of Mark Twain. On Friday's Morning Show, Hope Jahren and her book, The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. This is the newest book from one of the most important voices when it comes to concerns of climate change. And by the way, at the outset of the interview, we spend a couple of minutes talking about what it's like for Hope Jahren in the nation of Norway, where she now lives in the midst of this COVID-19 crisis. And we want to remind you that The Morning Show is also shared over the weekend as a podcast. 7 days a week, you can hear The Morning Show as a podcast. On Saturday, Mark Kreidler takes us into the joys and sometimes the sorrows of Little League Baseball with his wonderful book, Six Good Innings. And on Sunday, a lighthearted look at the world of self-help with Beth Lissick and her book, Helping Me Help Myself. You can look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast.